Welcome to the spoiler room. 8 weeks of Alfred Hitchcock. The next 8 episodes, we will be covering some films that are known and not so known of Alfred Hitchcock's. We hope you enjoy the show and aren't too scared. If you do get scared, please pause the podcast, have a drink, come back and finish the podcast. Thank you and enjoy.
And welcome, my friends. We are kicking off our 8 weeks of Hitchcock. Yes, for some reason I've decided, hey, you know what? Let's do 8 weeks straight of Alfred Hitchcock films. And you know the birds, you know North by Northwest, and you know Psycho, but he has made many other films out there that I think are worthy to discuss. And we may touch on some of those films over the course of these 8 weeks, but we're going to start off with one that, from 1946, and it's called Notorious. And to talk about Notorious tonight, I have with me in the spoiler room, Baby Spice, Scotty D. Hello, sir. How are you?
You can call me the Notorious SWD.
Oh, I like that. For now, shall ever be known as the Notorious S.
No, I still prefer Baby Spice. Baby Spice. Baby Spice gives me a tingle in ways that I don't fully disclose. So,
alrighty then. Well, glad you could join us tonight for this kickoff of this series. I'm kind of excited to explore some of these films. Some of them I haven't seen before, like the one tonight. I know, sacrilege, but I have not seen Notorious. Now, did you want to give the synopsis of Notorious?
Oh, sure. The film opens up in Miami, Florida, where a Nazi war criminal that was plotting against the U.S. has been put on trial and is being sentenced. Because, of course, if you're going to find your Nazis, they're going to find him in Florida. what we follow is the daughter of this traitor, who is this, they try to tiptoe around it with the production code at the time, but she's kind of a really lost soul, like a party girl, known for drunken antics, known for going from man to man and everything like that. And she is approached, she's played by Ingrid Bergman. Her name is, by the way, we'll do this so we don't have to go nuts throughout the show. Her name's Alicia, and she was played by Ingrid Bergman. And she is approached by the very suave, debonair Devlin, who's played by Cary Grant, who reveals himself to be a secret agent with the government, and says that we want to enlist you in a special assignment. We don't know what the assignment is, but we want to enlist you in this special assignment because we know that you never subscribed to your father's teachings and stuff like that. We think that you'd like to help clear, you know, your name and everything like that. And we think you could be a great service. Well, eventually she's kind of won over and she says, fine, we'll do it. And in the interim, before they find out the assignment, the two of them fall madly in love with each other. And she starts to kind of turn over a new leaf. Then she finds out that her assignment is to get close to this one of her father's friends who she knew years before and had a little fling with. And she gets close to him and has to basically seduce him and spy on him and then report back, which, of course, causes a serious ripple in Alicia's relationship with Devlin. So now there's this kind of tension between the two. Will these two ever get together? Can they get over this kind of illicit assignment? Do they have duty to country or to each other? And then also there's the danger of actually, you know, being in the midst of actual Nazi war criminals that are still planning horrible things for the world. So that's what we're talking about here.
Nice. Nice summary. Yeah, that is what we were talking about here. I mean, this film is like fresh. I mean, the ink was still fresh on the final ending of World War II. So, I mean, what, maybe a year? So this was still on everyone's mind, so it was a very topical film. I imagine when it came out at the time, very intriguing. And yeah, the cast, Claude Rains, Ingrid Bergman, Cary Grant. I mean, you know, Ingrid Bergman and Claude Rains, they were in Casablanca together, right? If I remember correctly.
Yes. She, of course, played Ilsa, and Claude Rains played Renault.
Yes. So, you know, I mean, you've got that pairing again from that classic film. And then, of course, Cary Grant and Ingrid Bergman as well. I mean, so there's a lot of big names. This was probably considered a big film.
Oh, huge. And, you know, Alfred Hitchcock was huge at that time. You know, he had, I'm not sure how his most recent films had been. He had worked with, he had had kind of ups and downs recently. Rebecca, of course, was huge and stuff like that. But at the same time, and but you know, I think Shadow of a Doubt, I don't think know if that one went did as well and everything. So they were kind of playing with each other. But also, he had worked with everybody before. Hitchcock had done Spellbound with Ingrid Bergman, right. And he had done Suspicion with Cary Grant and everything. So,
and in fact, Spellbound was the one previous to this, and it was, I guess, getting really good reviews and such.
Mm-hmm. Now I will out myself as something horrible, saying that I still haven't gotten to Spellbound, which I think is a huge omission. Personally, for my own viewing, as like I've always meant to get to it. You know, that's the one with all the Dali stuff in it. Oh my god! But I haven't gotten to that one yet. So, yeah, kill me.
Yeah, well, you know, you only have so many hours in the day to watch films. So you know,
that's what they keep telling me.
So yes, we have the suave Cary Grant in here as Devlin and Ingrid Bergman, and you know what stood out for me. This was my first viewing of this, and first off, I loved all the performers in it. I mean, you know, Ingrid Bergman as Alicia, who originally, I guess, was supposed to be a sex worker. In I guess an original script, her character was actually supposed to be a sex worker instead of a socialite type party girl. Loved her performance, and Cary Grant as well, but. What got me with this film is, you know, people talk about Alfred Hitchcock, all this and that, but for me, this really felt like a modern film as far as the way it was edited and the cinematography in here. Wouldn't you agree, Scott, that, I mean, for films of its nature, I mean, from editing to, I mean, you know, there's a lot of things that I kind of want to talk about in here, but one of the things just starting off in it was how strong this film starts off with. And it moves things pretty quickly for a film from 1946, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's constantly. The funny thing is that when you look at this movie, you're not sure if there's not a lot happening or if there's a lot happening. And he's always very, very careful how he works the camera. He is from the beginning, we see the trial of the Nazi war criminal from the outside, because that's not our story. Our story is outside that courtroom where the woman is, you know, walking past reporters and not saying a word. The introduction of Cary Grant is just sitting there in total silhouette at the at the party. And it's very mysterious and everything. And you think, oh my gosh, this is going to be a huge reveal. And then it just cuts to the next scene and there he is.
Yeah.
And, you know, you know, it's a, he's always kind of playing around with things like that. Now, as far as editing is concerned, there's a lot of shots that go on for a very long period of time. And I don't think you realize just how many there are. The ones that tend to go back and forth are kind of more interrogation type scenes, I would say.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So when they're, because throughout this, Devlin and of course, Alicia have developed feelings for each other, and then they get their assignment. And so while she's spying on Alex, they occasionally cross paths so they can get updates on the information Alicia has gotten. And those scenes, you're right, are cut differently than the scenes we get with just Carrie, with Devlin and Alicia when they're alone and being romantic.
And I would even say that the scenes where they're trying to make nice and everything, you'll see is often like a two shot.
Right.
You know, but when they start doing these passive aggressive jabs at each other, even before the assignment, even when he's trying to resist his feelings and he really is judgy about her because
he is,
you know, because, you know, it's just like, I mean, they had to tiptoe around it so much, but, you know, whether they put her in as a sex worker or not, they really want to imply she's been around the block a lot. She has, you know, a drinking problem and everything like that. And there's a back and forth cut between the two of them during those scenes, and then between the interrogation scenes when there's the jealousy, the scenes where you see that again are you see the scenes between the Nazis cross-examining each other, and also when Cary Grant is getting instructions from his superiors. The back and forth between them, they're at odds to each other. So when they're at odds, there's all this cutting back and forth, but there's a lot of scenes where there are these very long master shots, and maybe the camera is doing a lot of moving around, but there's not a lot of cutting. And so it changes from scene to scene. And that's why I like that, because I think that it recognizes the importance of camera work and editing in telling the story. It's very subtle how he does it. I like it.
Yeah, and now that you mention it, I guess there are longer scenes, but the camera, the way it's moving and such, it's always moving. Something's moving in frame. Something's going on. Whereas some other films of this time that I'm used to seeing, you have the static shot, and it's even quiet to where, you know, you get that telltale hiss of the audio, you know, when nothing's really going on, and you could hear it, you know, because of the way it was recorded in that. And here you don't get, I mean, the film feels like it's constantly moving. I think the pacing of this film, you know, moves, it just keeps going. I was very impressed by how the pacing of it, how it moved in. And they, you could tell too, though, the old school way, because we do not get chunks of, well, like Alicia starts, you know, she starts wooing Alexander so she could get in good with him, and suddenly they're married, but we don't see the wedding.
No.
We find out afterwards, or, you know, I mean, you know, you get some of these things, but I don't think that took away from anything at all because of the way they told the story. Do you think that did, Scott, the fact we actually kind of jump ahead in time quite a bit?
I don't think it hurt the story at all. And I think there's two reasons for doing that. One is to stick to the meat of the story. The tension, which are the tension between the two lovers, the duty to country, and the danger of the Nazis. I think that's the meat of the story right there. And, you know, how all of those kind of collide in together. Another is what I had mentioned before, is I think that they needed to really be careful because the production code was still very new at this time. It still was new. You know, it was only like a dozen years or so being enforced. And whereas they may have gotten away with a lot more if this movie was made in like 1932.
Right.
But they didn't. So you have to say, well, even though they show Claude Rains and Ingrid Bergman sleeping in like
separate beds,
twin beds, that yes, that she is sleeping with him.
Yeah.
To get information, you know, that's one of the main things that's driving Cary Grant crazy is that she has to sleep with this guy, with this old Nazi, to get information. You know, I think that they had to imply certain things. I always wondered that, incidentally. Did you ever wonder that watching these old movies and TV shows? these kids would go to the movies or they'd see TV shows. The first generation to really see TV, it was popping up, say, like in the 10 years after this. And they would always see these twin beds in movies and TV shows.
Yeah.
Now, I don't know how life was totally back then, but I'm assuming that that the parents didn't sleep in twin beds.
Yeah. I think
that like all these kids grew up thinking my parents must be deviants. Is what I'm always thinking. It's because, like, you know, Lucy and Desi don't sleep in the same bed. What the hell?
Mom, Dad, how come you don't have two beds?
Yeah. I'm worried about the beaver. Anyway, yeah. But to get back to it, yeah, I always thought that that was so. I always thought it kind of had a double purpose, is to stick to the meat of the story and also to, you know, let's not get us banned in Peoria. You
know? We have that great conversation too of how you know she is sleeping with him, because Cary Grant earlier in the film, he's being very judgmental of her. Actually, his character's big old prick.
Yeah. Yeah, and if he didn't come, spoiler room, folks, it's called the spoiler room. If he didn't come clean at the end and totally admit that he was being a big fat-headed guy, I'm like, yep, damn right you were, Gary.
Really,
it wouldn't be endearing, but he was like, oh my god. It's kind of funny to see somebody admit to toxic masculinity back in 1946.
Yeah.
But he did. Yeah. But you know, he was completely judgy. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, but yeah, he was judgy, and so he talks about how she, as Scott mentioned too, how she kind of jumped from a boy toy to boy toy. And so these two find, you know, emotions, then they get their job, and she's got to woo Alexander. And so I think it's the first time they meet up to get information or exchange information. He asks how it's going, and she seems kind of reluctant. And she said something to the effect of, well, you can just call him another one of my, you know, say I've got another, a new boy toy or something along that lines. Those words, but basically implying, you know, she has slept with him.
Yeah.
But they do it so well. That's what I love some of these films back then, is how they got around some of those conversations just by, you know, body language and phrasing. And you get that in here. I mean, she totally implies that, yep, I slept with him. And Cary Grant's Devlin's character knows exactly what she means, and they just totally change towards each other. Well, he does, mostly.
Mm-hmm.
Never mind the fact he put her in this position in the first place.
Yeah. I don't know what he thought that she was going to... I don't know what they thought that he thought that she was... they were going to ask her to do. I mean, it's not like... I mean, he is a well-skilled government person. Yeah. He's probably done a lot of, you know, questionable things in his life.
Mm-hmm.
And then he falls for this girl, which is very unprofessional, of course. It's so romantic. And anyway, but he, you know, I don't know what they thought. I mean, he even says she doesn't have any training. She doesn't. No, she's known for her connections and for being a promiscuous alcoholic.
Yeah.
Clearly, those are the two skills we're going to drop off.
We just need someone who's promiscuous and who's an alcoholic.
She's a promiscuous. She's an alcoholic. Her dad's a Nazi.
There you go.
Back in those days, they called that a triple threat.
Which we have to point out just how many times Devlin makes comment about her drinking. I mean, this guy just can't let it go.
And he's no teetotaler.
No, he's not. He's just like constantly, he's like, oh, it's 10 o'clock. Oh, you're having a drink already? Oh, you've been sober 8 days. Wow. So, you know.
Well, he's very cynical, too. Yeah, I mean, government work makes you very cynical. And he's trying to avoid. I love this part, because this is something else that they cut through. They cut through the BS about it. You know, I'm going to use an example of when they remade a movie recently. And believe it or not, they remade this one for USA Network in the 80s, and I'd rather forget it.
Oh, dear.
But yeah, it was not good. But I'm going to go to the remake of, remember the remake of King Kong when Peter Jackson did that?
Yep, I remember.
All right, great. And I love the original King Kong, and I wanted to see what Peter did with it, but it's a very long movie, and like an hour is spent saying, "Oh, you shouldn't go to that island." You shouldn't go to that island. Well, I'm like, we know they're going to go to the island. So why spend a whole hour with you shouldn't go to the island? Spend like 10 minutes with you shouldn't go to the island. Spend 15 minutes with you shouldn't go to the island, but not an hour. And this movie, you know they're going to fall in love.
Yeah.
And in a lesser movie, falling in love would be the end of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
In this one, it's the beginning. So they need to get to it. So you don't see this long, boring courtship. You see where he's really tough and he's like being kind of hard on her, but he obviously likes her, and she obviously likes him. But they're kind of at odds with each other. And then eventually, there's a scene where you get to, that they've been together for a few days, and finally they just kiss, and they're just like, and you know, the music swells and everything. That's really all you need.
Yeah.
That's really all you need, because of their chemistry. And Cary Grant, and this cannot be stressed enough, Cary Grant and Ingrid Bergman have incredible chemistry in this movie.
Oh, yeah.
Just like some of the best ever, really. Because of their incredible chemistry, you buy it. It doesn't seem superficial.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, and they get to the meat and potatoes of that, you know? They have a way of like kind of cutting through it really quickly, I think. So he's kind of cruel to her at first, and then he's very cynical. He's government work, but then he kind of folds and everything like that. And then, you know, he's faced with what this assignment is, and she's faced with what this assignment is, and both of them are too proud and to be the one to say, "No, I don't want to do this. I feel horrible about this." <you know?
laughs> Yeah, and the way their personalities collide too. It's just like you can tell they almost want to tell each other, but by God, their pride just won't let them. And then it just takes one to spark the other. And then, which is interesting because this is deemed a thriller, which it does. This has some, Alfred builds some great tense moments just from the editing and direction and the way the story plays out. Don't get me wrong, there's a lot of thrilling moments. But when the music swelled, you know, because I saw that it was described as a thriller, and you watch this, and when the film starts up with the type of music, I'm like, oh, it's got a love story too, because it's got that telltale.
As far as I'm concerned, this is a love story. It's a love story with aspects of a thriller.
Right,
but this is a love story. Absolutely, it's probably the most romantic movie he ever made. Certainly the most optimistically romantic movie. We'll say that, you know, because somebody could say like, "What about Vertigo?" Like, optimistically.
No, in a happy, in an upbeat way.
Yeah,
Yeah, the way it starts off and the music and everything about it, you realize that, you know, love is the angle in here that they take with this. But I love the relationship between Cary Grant and Ingrid Bergman. And we've got to mention Claude Rains' character, Alexander. He's the third wheel in this film, this poor guy. He's the Russian age, German. Russian was 1992. Sorry. That was the remake you mentioned. I had brought it up quick, and that he was a communist spy versus German.
Damn commies.
Damn commies. But in here, he's German, underground. These guys are still trying to get their rise to power. And there's a plot in here of them getting uranium. But Claude Rains as Alexander Sebastian has some familiar characteristics to another Alfred Hitchcock character, in that he really loves his mommy.
What is it with Hitchcock and mothers, man?
I don't know, but I'm watching this and going, okay, this part kind of feels familiar. Mm-hmm. Claude Rains as Alexander Sebastian has this rather unusual relationship with his mother that was very, was very psycho-esque.
Mm.
Was it? I mean, did you get a kind of a little bit of Norman? Only, you know, not the crazy murder side, but just how close he was to mommy.
There is something there's something in there where he has something about domineering mother figures.
Yeah.
And I would even say that, who's the character? Even reminds me a little bit of the character in Rebecca, mm-hmm. who is kind of the domineering figure in that, whose name now I keep forgetting, and that's a terrible thing to do on the live show. But
no,
there's just something in, you know, this one, I think that, you know, because they never really tell you the depths of the relationship in the original Psycho that came in the later movies and on the TV show and, you know, everything else that they've done with that. But this one, I think, rather than just being like this old shrew, she was a very, you know, calculating and very controlling woman. And you kind of almost get the feeling that a lot of his ideals probably even came from her. You know, just this really not awful, like, not this person who looks like she's just spends times knitting sweaters, but, you know, really she's like this Nazi battle axe. And he has something about, well, first of all, we all know, let's say Hitchcock's feelings towards women were complex.
Especially towards Ingrid Bergman, among others, but
or any of his leading ladies, just practically. It was not very unsorted, we'll say. It was
no.
You know, and I think that he felt that he had a thing of also with these domineering mother figures and everything like that. And that I think that there was some kind of menace about women in control, older women in control.
Yeah.
You know, if the woman was in control, they had better at least be sexy about it. And if the woman was not sexy, then they and were in control, then that's something to be feared. And in a lot of the movies, you get that the woman that's in control either is saved by the man or is doesn't have a very good time of it for being in control, you know, mm-hmm. Such as in Psycho. And I think that there's something going on here. I'm trying to pick a dead man's brain here, but you had issues, dude.
You can't have the same theme crop up across multiple films of yours without people to start wondering.
It's like Tarantino, you know? And Pete, you know. You know, he could laugh it off as much as he wants. Like, you got a thing with feet. You know, Hitchcock has a thing with women in places of power.
In power. And the mom of Alexander, played by Leopoldine Constantine, who is actually not much older than Claude Rains. You go for old school casting. What are you going to do? Mm-hmm. But what I found interesting about Claude Rains as Alexander, what I found interesting about Alexander's character was, yes, he's a German. We're talking a film that was made just a year or so after World War II was officially, finally, completely considered over. Yet his character, you actually feel some sympathy for him. Am I wrong in that, Scott? Did you kind of, they build some sympathy for Alexander?
A little bit. Now, keep in mind, I am, you know, because of recent events in my own country's history, I am fully in the mode of, is ultimately, fuck him and fuck Nazis.
Well, yes. But... no, completely. No, we're not condoning who his character was, but
yes, you get the feeling that he is not put in as a completely demonic person. He is put as somebody who has very human feelings and everything like that. Now, ultimately, we don't care about that because when backed into a corner, he yes. runs to mommy and gets the horrible idea of slowly murdering his wife.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, is a monstrous thing to do, you know, to say nothing about whatever the hell he's got planned with whatever
uranium
what they're doing, yeah, which they didn't really fully explain because it's kind of a MacGuffin. But the idea is that they're trying to develop their own nuclear power.
Yeah, well, that's the whole thing with uranium. Apparently, actually, Alfred Hitchcock and the writer or whatever actually asked a guy who was involved with the bombing, you know, on a sign, how do you, you know, is this how you make a bomb? And he wouldn't tell them, but he did say, yes, you could fit uranium in a wine bottle. That was the most, apparently they would tell them is, yes, you can put uranium in a wine bottle. that's the most I'm telling you though.
But yeah, but no, he Claude Rains is a, he's somewhat sympathetic. Towards the end, though, I think that we are meant to sit. I always did kind of giggle with glee at the end. And this is one of those Hitchcock movies that doesn't have the epilogue scene.
Oh, yeah.
It's one of the rare movies where a lot of things where is they'll have like a cute little epilogue scene so that you can exhale before you leave the theater.
Yeah.
You know, the remake of Man Who Knew Too Much has a short one. The Rear Window has one, you know. This is one of those movies like The Birds or Vertigo where it doesn't have one. It just it's got the tension thing, it's resolved and it's over. You know, yeah. And that's what happened here. And so I always kind of did giggle with glee at the end, no matter how much they tried to make him a three-dimensional character. I think that they showed that he was human, but that he had problems himself. I think that there's also kind of a recalling of that
mm-hmm.
in when she is recalling her father.
Yes.
There's a scene where they're on their way to Rio to get their assignment. And Cary Grant has to give the news that her father, Ingrid Bergman's father, has committed suicide in his prison cell, cyanide capsule. And she says, I don't have to be mad at him or myself anymore.
Right.
And she says, you know, when he told me what he was, I didn't care anything about myself. I didn't care anything about this. You know, she was just disgusted. She was horrified. He was a monster. He was horrible because, you know, he was. But he says, now all I can think about is how nice he used to be and how nice we used to be to each other. You know, it's these people, when we talk about these monsters, and a lot of them are monsters. Don't make no mistake about that. It's the idea that they like just kind of come out of the depths of the earth. And come out as monsters and everything else, and they're nothing but that. But no, there's a lot of people, things where you say, but they're always so nice, and they always had a good sense of humor. I think it's why you get so many people, when somebody does something horrible, they say, oh, but they've always been nice to me.
Yeah.
You know? Right? Or, you know, they always had something nice to say to me, or that's something, or we used to joke around. Yeah, it doesn't matter because when they weren't with you, they were doing these horrible things, and one doesn't necessarily make up for the other. It just makes you a person,
right?
You know, so yeah.
Yeah, and don't get me wrong. I mean, by the end, no, you have no sympathy.
Oh no, I know that. Yeah,
but I mean, when you first for a chunk of the film, they build this sympathy around him, kind of like he's a guy caught, you know, in. in just this situation. But then you realize, you remember again, especially when it's revealed uranium's in the wine bottles, just how, you know, nope, that's right, Alexander's a bad guy. You know, we had you going for a little while of him feeling like the third wheel, but nope, he's a bad guy. Does the slow poisoning, which I thought was interesting, because the first time Devlin meets Alicia after she's been poisoned a few times already, he thinks she's on a bender. Mm-hmm. Just immediately thinks she's on a bender. But you get that great scene. And there's a couple scenes that I just want to talk about that are great in here. And the one in particular is the reveal when she does put two and two together that she's being poisoned, was with the coffee cup. Mm. And that shot from the table with the coffee cup of her staring at it. Alfred does this great thing of taking some common actions and building tension around them. And one of them is drinking coffee in this film when she's getting poisoned. Mm-hmm. And it's in this scene where they're having a conversation. She's already not feeling good, and they're talking to a doctor, and there's two coffee cups, and the mom's bringing the coffee cup to her, and you're like, don't drink it. It's poison.
Yeah.
You know, and then she puts it down, and you see the doctor standing behind her, and there's two coffee cups, and you're like, oh, is he going to drink the wrong one? I mean, and all it is a scene of people talking with cups. But Alfred, he constructs this in such a way that, you know, and then the camera angles, like with the coffee cup really up close and her kind of looking at the coffee cup once she realizes it's poisoned. It's like, get out of the room. I mean, that scene there, I thought was really well crafted. What'd you feel about that with the reveal with the poison? You know, is that kind of an example of some of Alfred's talent of taking common things and just building so much tension around them?
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. He takes the mundane and does that. They talk about the, what is he? He often talks about the bomb under the dinner table.
Oh yeah.
He says that, you know, he says that you can show people just having a dinner conversation, but there's a bomb under the table, and that's what suspense is.
Mm-hmm.
That's the difference between a scare and suspense. And, but it's important that the bomb not go off.
Right.
Which is just like such a like totally talk about giving your audience blue balls there. And and what happens here, you expect, you know, there to be fresh out. Well, this is the scene where she realizes what's happening to her. It's so important.
Right.
And you think, oh my God, a shot's gonna ring out. No, it happens. No, they just take her upstairs. Only now there is consequences, because she knows that she can't escape. She's too weak to escape.
Right.
Well, they now they're going to drug her as well.
Well, they do that thing where they take her upstairs and they're like, oh, we'll take the phone out of her so it's not disturbing her. And you're like, oh, damn it.
Yeah. It's like, shit. I was always surprised they didn't lock the door.
Yeah, that surprised me too. But speaking of locks, there's the other tension with the key.
Mm-hmm.
Just doing a simple thing of her taking a key, and he makes it suspenseful in here. Like, you get that awesome shot, which, folks, you know, you watched enough films, especially from this time period, you recognize when you have a director doing something unique. And here we get this cool long shot from like the upper balcony of this mansion where Alex lives, and Alex and Alicia are standing and greeting their guests, and you're from a distance, and this camera goes from the second floor balcony all the way down to her hand holding the key. I'm like, Scott, I'm watching a scene going with, especially knowing, you know, the technology back then, that had to be a hell of a shot to try to get.
I don't know how people had the patience to deal with Hitchcock's shit about how he would get these great shots. I think they just knew that, trust me, when this comes off, it's going to be amazing. No one's ever done this before.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, he crafted these things so he was so particular about how scenes were shot, even scenes without dialogue, sometimes especially scenes without dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
I was watching, if I could just talk about another one real quick.
Sure, go ahead.
I just a few days ago watched, finally got around to watching Strangers on a Train.
Okay, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Which is, I don't think you're covering that for your eight.
No, we aren't.
Weeks,
nope. That's, nope.
There's a scene in there which is just, oh man, it is so tense. And it's just, it is the simple thing of a person trying to retrieve a cigarette lighter.
Mm-hmm.
From down a sewer drain, and he's got his arm down and he's trying to reach down and see if he can reach it, and it goes on for minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And Hitchcock was so particular that he even handpicked the pieces of garbage that would end up in the shot.
Oh geez.
I mean, he was that particular. He says, like, no, we're going to be focused on this, you know. He wanted to make sure that the actual scene, that the actual, as they would say in his native country, the rubbish around,
yes,
the action was perfect for the shot. It was believable, but not too eye-catching and everything like that. And he was that particular that he would rummage around the garbage and handpick the garbage that could be visible in the shot. It's from down in the sewer drain. As you just saw this endless close-up of this hand trying to reach down towards a cigarette lighter. That's the type of thing that he's dealing with in this key scene as well. It's also with this coffee scene was involved doing like some weird practical special effects and everything like that, just for a coffee scene. I mean, it's crazy, but I mean, it's but he would do these. He would imagine these things, and I think that he was one of these people who would imagine these great sequences and then kind of build the movies around them.
Yeah,
I think he was one of those people, and the reason why he succeeded where others failed was that he not only took such great care in these sequences. Once he got around to it, he actually did take his equal amount of care in the other scenes as well.
Yeah, oh yeah, I can picture him reading a script and, oh, this is going to be a cool scene here and a cool scene here and a cool scene here. This is how we're going to do this whole thing. Okay, now let's see, how are we going to shoot the rest of this?
I think that where a lot of people fail in this, Argento sometimes got accused of this like 50 years later,
mm-hmm.
Or 30 years later, or however many years. And it would be say that there are all these great, amazing sequences. And then when they actually had to focus on the story was like Swiss cheese. A lot of the critics, the people who are more critical about them than, say, people from our background,
mm-hmm.
Would say that the story didn't hold up. Well, his films, they kind of held up because he took equal amount of care with all the scenes, which a lot of people would say, well, these are the boring scenes.
No,
but what he would often do is he would often consider it. He would plan every single shot, every single motion, every single everything, and he always considered the actual filming of the movie to be the boring part.
The boring part.
Yeah, I heard that somewhere. I can't remember where I heard that, but I did hear that somewhere.
I can believe that. Yeah, I can believe that. But I mean, with Notorious, I didn't really feel any boring part. I mean, the way this film moves, but the shots that he did in here for especially 1946, you're just like, there's also a shot which you got to realize what type of cameras they're working with. He does this POV shot of Alicia when she's on the bed, when she wakes up after first getting pulled over for a DUI for being drunk and driving. She's laying on the bed and she wakes up and she sees Cary Grant staring at his door. You just see his silhouette. But as he walks up, it kind of gets this half-closed eye look, and it actually kind of spins around, and like she's watching him walk towards her bed. And I'm just like, that could not have been easy with those heavy, big, heavy phone cameras.
This is not someone's iPhone that they're flipping around. No, this is a major rig that they're actually doing for that. And honestly, all I can think about is that scene is like, yep, I've had hangovers exactly like that. Where, here comes somebody towards the bed and they're upside down. I'd better not move.
Yeah, you know, it's one of those things where you get a lot of those interesting shots in Notorious. And yeah, we talked about the Nazis in here. Alexander is working with the scientists who are hiding uranium in his wine bottles in a cellar. So there's this group of Nazis he's working with, and they do this great thing Scott alluded to at the end, and I just want to bring it up, and that's how we'll kind of finish up, is how they end. You know, you think Cary Grant, he manages to get back to the mansion. He catches up. He's like, okay, I'm taking Alicia out of here. We're leaving. You know, he doesn't care if it's revealed that he's actually a agent and not a guy who just tagged along on an airplane. Mm-hmm. And so he's revealed, and you think, oh great, you know, the gig is up. The mom and Alexander both know who everybody is now. But the mom and Alexander are caught in a conundrum because they were
hiding it before from the Nazis as well. Because
right.
He knew that if the wife was an American agent and was revealed, no matter what they did, he would be killed off too.
Yeah,
and even though it's not said, so is the mom.
Right. Oh yeah. No, it's totally not said, but it's the mom. So you get this scene where they're just walking down the stairs, and you're like, oh great, you know, how's this gonna end? And you realize that he's got them, because they can't reveal, because they're gonna get killed, and so they gotta play nice all the way until he walks her to the car. And I think you get kind of a little mini, not a prologue, but a little mini relief, because once Devlin and Alicia get in the car to drive away, you got Alexander suddenly going, take me with you, please take me with you, because his Nazi buddies have just seen this whole scene and they're going, what the hell's going on? And he's like, nope, sorry, we got no room for you. And Cary Grant drives off. And yeah. Alexander takes that slow walk up the stairs, and the door closes and the music crescendos. He's like, that is an awesome ending.
Oh, it's fantastic. That sudden ending. It's over that I was giggling with glee, because it's like, it's such a kiss off. They don't have to kill the bad guy. They don't have to shoot the bad guy. And the resolution turns out to be amazingly simple. So it's like, I'm saying hell with all of you, I'm taking the woman I love out of here, and there's really not a damn thing you can do about it, and I'm leaving you. And when he says, like, you know, as he says to, you know, Claude Rains, when he says, like, well, no, they're he says they'll know something's up, you know, that's your headache.
Yeah,
you know. And just drives off, you know, she's smiling, and she said they just drive off. It's just this great thing, like, ah, gotcha. Yeah.
And he doesn't have to show the aftermath. He doesn't have to have any extra dialogue. All you do is watch Alexander walk up the stairs, and the door closes, and it's ending. You know what's gonna happen next.
No, they're done. Yeah, they're done. They're gonna find their body in a lake somewhere or something. Yeah.
Alex and mom are gonna disappear because their Nazi buddies don't trust them, even though they may not have done anything wrong except not coming clean right away that she was an agent. Doesn't matter. They're so suspicious at this point, because as we mentioned, the end of the war is still fresh, so you don't know who your friends are.
Even towards the end, that was always a thing, that the
right
Nazis were always there was always like stories about people being disappeared and everything like that, because the paranoia was so rife, especially as it got towards the end of the war. Mm-hmm. And of course now even afterwards, you know. Yeah.
The paranoia was definitely played there. I mean, you know, it's so played so well, but this whole film, I was like, yeah, this was a great film. Okay. You know, I'm like sitting here going, I'm looking forward to doing these other Alfred Hitchcock episodes for sure. Because again, I wasn't familiar. I fully admit, I only know the real popular ones. Mm-hmm. You know, he's got a great catalog, but I only know the main ones. So But even looking at this one, because this one was had he made a lot of films before Notorious? Because he actually, Alfred Hitchcock.
Before Notorious? Oh, yes.
Yeah, so I mean, he'd been established for a while in films. So.
Oh yeah, he was a couple decades in, and then and of course, like around 1940 is when he made his appearance in America.
Right.
After becoming the most celebrated British director in the world, first in The Silence and then in The Sound, one of the very few directors to make the a successful jump from silent to sound. And then, of course, you know, well, the rest is history. Yeah.
Right. So I feel horrible because I honestly, you know, the name and you know, the movies, but like, I'm sure many out there, I am, you know, a novice with the Alfred Hitchcock of his earlier works. And so that's why I kind of wanted to do these as well. And yeah, the Notorious, just, I was like engrossed in this film from the start. And just a side note before we close out, folks, if you think, oh, how can you say these two really had chemistry? Look at that on-screen kiss. As Scott had mentioned, there were the decency laws in place, so they couldn't have a kiss that long. So they had to get creative for the longer love scenes.
And they're just caressing each other and everything. And you don't think about it as a skirt. You think about it as these people are just so happy to see each other and everything. Yeah. So yeah,
I fully admit that some of those kissing scenes are like, well, that's kind of awkward kissing. But they could only kiss a certain way and only for such a certain length that it's like, oh, that makes sense. That's right. There were the acts where they could only do something for so long. And so you're trying to show passion, but still stay within the standards. And you end up getting a bit of an awkward kissing scene.
Well, you know, this film, I'm going to come clean also and say that even though it's not as flashy as a lot of the other Hitchcock films, it is, this is the reason why I right away said, yes, I wanted to be on the show for Notorious. Notorious is my favorite Hitchcock movie.
Really?
Cool. I don't know. And some of that might be sentiment.
Sure.
Because it was also one of the earliest Hitchcock films I ever saw.
Oh, okay.
And it was the film that introduced me to Cary Grant. It was the film that introduced me to Ingrid Bergman. It was the film that introduced me to Claude Rains. And so all these actors are people I love. This director is someone I love. And I just thought this film is, when I saw this, I said, that is an amazing film. I want to see everything. I've got to see this Casablanca movie now, you know? I think that Cary Grant is a fantastic actor. I think that he is the absolute epitome of suave.
Oh God, yeah.
This movie. I mean, you can't look at this movie and tell me that he was not at least some of the inspiration for James Bond.
Oh yeah.
He is so amazingly cool. And then not too cool that he can't show weakness.
Right.
And of course, then you see his later movies and you see not too cool that he can't also poke a lot of fun at himself.
Mm-hmm.
Then you see Ingrid Bergman and she's just, you know, radiant. And her acting is incredible. So I, of course, love films like this, Casablanca, Intermezzo. And then Claude Rains, you know, I love this movie. This is one of those movies that I've just go to again and again and again. I hadn't seen it for a few years until I just revisited it really just before we did the show.
Sure.
It was one of my first Hitchcock films and it is still my favorite Hitchcock film.
And I can see why, because it's an excellent film. And I know I'm going to revisit it again, because this is one of those films that pulled me in. I was like, you know, I'm in on this film. This is, it grabs you and keeps you there. And with all this talent and such involved, you can see why. Really, I mean,
the Criterion comes out in a couple months, people.
Oh, does it? Does it really?
Yeah,
it
does.
Oh my! I have to put that on my Christmas list or birthday list.
My
for
horrible
one,
spending habits. You know that that's going to be there. Yeah. Yeah.
So there you have it, folks. Notorious. I hope you enjoyed this discussion. These are going to be fun episodes, I think, exploring these. Like I said, I fully admit, and I know people will say, well, that just we're just going to take your movie watching card away, because I'm not that familiar with the other works of Alfred outside of the very popular ones. So this is going to be fun. Thank you, Scott, for sitting down and talking to me with this film tonight. You know, I'm looking forward to the others. And yeah, I hope our listeners are too. So now I know you haven't written on it recently, but you get a license to shill here. Why don't you post? I know it's a little dusty, but
it's very dusty. It's been dusty for several reasons, and hopefully eventually it'll get dusted off soon. But you know, we'll find out. Once upon a time, I could write pretty decently. So
I'm sure you still can write,
it's out there still. You can read all my old stuff at moviocrity.com. You can also see my old web series Moviocrity. Best place is Vimeo, so that you can go to vimeo.com/channels/moviocrity.
Awesome. Yes, check that stuff out. There's links on the Special Mark Productions page as well. And so we will just say a good night, folks. I hope you would stick with us as we take this journey to the end of the year exploring Alfred Hitchcock films. And now it's time to say good evening. So say good evening, Scott.
Good evening.
Good evening. And now I want to watch Alfred Hitchcock Presents.